Let's start. He's not here yet. So we can imagine it. He's stuck in traffic. Anna's chairing.
Well, I think we should probably wait. If everyone's okay, we'll wait 5 minutes or so.
Why are you all here? Why are you all interested in the LRA? Start with the floor. Let's begin with questions. Yeah. Anybody got any questions before we start? Fred, we're waiting for you to ask a question. We decided to do it round the other way, and we're going to begin with questions and work our way up to the talk.
Oh, I feel bad because it might get answered in the talk.
No, we don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. We're doing this because he's stuck in traffic, so we're ad-libbing. We're ad-libbing. Why don't you come up to the stage? You've worked in northern Uganda. Come and answer some questions. This is Fred Lacaire, who's worked, he did a PhD on northern Uganda. And this is Matt Green. Don't go there, yeah, come up here. Yeah, excellent. Yes. you come in. Yeah. Yeah. Right. There you go, there you can check.
Do you want to say something?
Well, I was actually going to ask the question of, given where Uganda is at the moment.
Sorry.
Thank you, let me just introduce myself. My name is Dr. Frederick Laker. I teach in the government department. But I wrote my PhD on internal displacement, and northern Uganda was my case study as the poster child of the whole IDP regime, with the camps in the north where 2 million people were displaced, and also looking at why the war had lasted so long. This is back from 2006 to 2014. And one thing I was going to ask, now that I'm on the panel... was really the question of the war being exported, in terms of when we look at ending civil wars, the way in which now we have the situation where you have an exported war, and northern Uganda is apparently in peace, and suddenly the whole war has been forgotten about, everyone's now gone back home from the camps, people are living their lives, but in neighboring Central African Republic, things are alive and well. And it's really the question now of, you know, we had Kony 2012, and, you know, Kony was going to be defeated, and it was going to be an end to the war. Now it's kind of, well, they're back, and where does this leave northern Uganda? Where does this leave the way we understand the political economy of war? Where does it leave, you know, understanding a group like the LRA, which is pretty much can be described as a quasi-terrorist rebellion rather than as an insurgency in the traditional sense? I mean, you can't compare the LRA to the SPLA or the ANC or to other more established groups with, you know, real political goals or achievable political goals, so to speak. And so it's really a question now of where do we see ourselves, given we had a 25-year civil war in northern Uganda, but now it's kind of the war's been exported to another country, and does Uganda take responsibility for that, or is everything now just fine and forgotten? So that was really something I was going to explore, but...
You're meant to be chairing. Anna, what do you think?
I thought it was interesting that the Ugandan government said that they were going to withdraw, because there is this AU regional task force, isn't there? So there's an AU regional task force that's supposed to be operational in Central Africa and DRC and in areas of South Sudan to try and track Kony, to hunt down the LRA, to try and finally kind of wipe them out. So there's the Ugandan government, there's supposed to be the Central African Republic, the Congolese government, and the South Sudanese, armies and the South Sudanese army, but I think only the UPDF has really been engaged in this. I can't remember exactly when it was. Earlier this year, the Ugandan government said actually they're going to withdraw their 2,000 troops from this regional task force. And so I don't know where that leaves the kind of hunt for the LRA, but they do seem to be... Oh, there we go. living. Well, you can stay. You can pull up a chair if you like. Okay, so we will start again. I was hopefully Lideo can finish what I was saying. We were talking about the AU Regional Task Force and what's happening with that, but maybe that will come up in your talk. Is this on? Okay. I would not pronounce that correctly. Okay, so welcome everyone. Thank you for coming along tonight. My name's Anna MacDonald. I'm a fellow in the International Development Department, and apologies for that slightly surreal beginning to the evening, but we will now move into a slightly more conventional setup. And I'm very pleased tonight to be able to introduce you and to welcome Lideo Sakai. Okay, that's definitely not how I would have pronounced it, but very welcome to the LSE. We've got Matthew Green, whose name's much easier to pronounce, and Professor Tim Allen, and also Fred Laker. Is that how you?
Frederick Laker.
Okay, so and a new addition to the panel tonight. and we're going to discuss and debate today Kony 2016 and what's happened to the LRA. Lideo is a researcher and a writer. He's the author of an excellent new book, which I don't know if you brought along any copies that we can quickly advertise. Fantastic. Yeah. So this is the new book, When the Walking Defeats You, and it's a sort of memoir and account of one of Joseph Kony's bodyguards, who was with the LRA from kind of 2007, and it's a really interesting account of the kind of the period where the LRA were engaged in peace talks and the period after that where they had moved permanently out of northern Uganda. Lideo has worked for close to two decades in the Balkans and in Central Africa researching armed groups, demobilization and reintegration of former combatants, and he's an acknowledged authority on the LRA. He spent 8 years studying the LRA, firstly during a master's at Princeton University and later working as a consultant for the World Bank and the Enough Project and also the Small Arms Survey and the organization Resolve. Matthew Green is a journalist and he's author of a book called The Wizard of the Nile, The Hunt for Africa's Most Wanted, which I believe was published in 2008.
Correct.
Yeah. And there's an excellent, sort of gripping book about his own search for Joseph Kony. And it works quite well because Matthew kind of ends where Lydia's book starts. It sort of works quite well. Reading both books together would be highly recommended. So Matthew's book provides really fascinating insights as well into the kind of political, spiritual, and social angles of the LRA conflict in northern Uganda. And he has spent the last 14 or so years working as a correspondent for the FT and Reuters, has reported from more than 30 countries, beginning his career working in East and West Africa. And he also has a new book published very recently, called Aftershock, The Untold Story of Surviving Peace, Fighting War, Surviving Trauma, and Finding Peace. And you'll find there are leaflets scattered around the room. And this is a book that documents the post-conflict experience of British soldiers. Professor Tim Allen is head of department, head of the International Development Department here at the LSE, and director of the DFID-funded Justice and Security Research Program. And he's been working on northern Uganda since the early 1980s. And he's a leading expert on the Lord's Resistance Army, has published widely on the conflict in northern Uganda, and his co-edited collection, The LRA, Myth or Reality, is probably the sort of seminal academic text on the LRA. He's also written very widely on the impact of the International Criminal Court in northern Uganda in relation to the LRA conflict. So what we'll do tonight is Lydia will talk for sort of 10, 15 minutes or so, and then I'll invite, Fred, if you'd also like to, the three of you to sort of offer some reflections and thoughts. And then we will open the floor up to questions. For those Twitter... Oh, is everyone all right? Yeah. For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for tonight's event is hashtag LSEConey. And please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. It is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. So I'll begin by inviting Lydio to speak for 10 to 15 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, I apologize for being late. Traffic here is terrible. I will never complain about Kampala traffic again. Although Nairobi, that I will continue to. First of all, yes, so to clarify, yes, I am Albanian. I used to live here, I used to go to school here, and I've lived in Africa, I mean Central and East Africa mostly, and now I live in the US, so hence the sort of messed up accent. But I've spent about, as I said, 8 or more years working primarily on the LRA, and the result of that work, which has been mostly based on traveling to places like South Sudan, CAR, and DRC, while particularly when I was based in Kampala, is the book. I'm grateful also to the work of people like Professor Allen, as well as Matthew's book, on which I relied heavily, and I am happy that we are here together, because rightly so, the book is in many ways a history, a modern history of the LRA, specifically from 2008 or so, right after the so-called Juba peace talks that failed, and the LRA was attacked by the Ugandan army and scattered in 4 different countries, 5 if you sort of count the corner of Darfur in Sudan, where Kony is now believed to be based. But it's more than that. Obviously, it's the book is also a story of a young man who joined the LRA. It's his struggle to survive. It's a struggle to sort of make sense of a very difficult reality. And it's a coming-of-age story as well that I think many of us could potentially identify with. And that's sort of the key. It's one of my sort of like my aims for this book was to actually make it more sort of palatable for people to identify with someone or people like the LRA rebels that have often been described in the sort of most sort of terrible terms, kind of wanton killers and bent on violence and so on, including the leader, obviously, Joseph Kony. I'm scared to even bring up Kony 2012, but you know, some of you or maybe many of you know about the viral video and its criticism that I think it received about the issue being presented very sort of in simplistic terms, sort of white and black, and obviously sort of like very simple, the bad guys and the good guys, and that just is exactly what the book is not. What it's about, and I already joked with Professor Allen yesterday that someone told me in one of these book events that the book is actually a serious Kony 2012, which I think was supposed to be a compliment. I'm not sure if it is, but I took it as such. So, and to sort of delve a little bit more into the sort of the main character, unlike most people, not only in the LRA, but in many of these sort of rebellions that we're now witnessing, particularly like Boko Haram, the main character in the book, George, joins the LRA, and he's at an age, he's not a child soldier, he's I think 19, and he is fairly well educated, he's about a couple of terms from graduating A-levels, very smart, and has a keen eye for detail, and manages to sort of gain the trust of Joseph Kony, and as a result gain access and sort of have intimate moments intimate moments on part of Kony and his family, and it's something that I write about quite in the book, and it's the idea that you see a more humane side of someone like Joseph Kony or other fighters in the LRA. I have tried to not write too much. I mean, it's not a cheerful book, that's for sure. It's not a funny topic, obviously. But I've also tried to not focus exclusively on things like the gory details, the killings, the violence, which is not to say that I don't think that those, obviously, those things have not happened or that they don't matter. In fact, I want to very much specify that I understand very well the atrocities committed by the LRA. I've been on the sort of the side of the kind of victims, people that have borne the brunt of LRA attacks. I've documented the attacks. And I know it too well. I've been to places right after attacks have happened when seeing people that were hurt. And you know, those things are undeniable. Those things have happened, and they still continue to happen. But there is also this other side that usually goes, it's neglected, this idea that it's a war between victims and perpetrators, or rather the other one, perpetrators and victims. But the more you read about and understand the LRA, and I've done that by interviewing former members who come out, specifically ones that have come out after 2008, the more you understand that it's not very clear, particularly when it comes to the perpetrators. As you might know, Dominic Ongwen, a former LRA commander, is now in The Hague, accused of crimes, some of which were perpetrated against him in the first place. So, and this is something that I try to convey by telling George's story as well, in that it's a complex story of victims, but also perpetrators who blur the lines between perpetrator and victims, who themselves have been victimized. And to a certain extent, I also talk a bit about Kony's role as well in that sort of line of thinking. I have a chapter in there called Prisoner of the Spirits, and it refers to a conversation between George and Kony himself, who had by that point drunk a little bit of alcohol. Alcohol is usually banned in the LRA, but during the Juba talks, Kony allowed it again, or rather the Holy Spirit did, and as a way to celebrate what they thought would be perhaps a peaceful solution to the conflict. And in a sort of a bit of a moment of drunken tenderness, I suppose, Kony opens up and talks about the fact that he himself is a hostage to the spirits. He's been abducted by the spirits and is made to do all of these things. And it's an interesting, I'm not sure what that might mean in sort of many deep levels, but it certainly talks to Kony's own beliefs that he is chosen by a higher power to try and right the wrongs that were perpetrated against the sort of the Acholi people of northern Uganda. And that's an important point that I want to maybe sort of finish on. I'm not sure what my timing is exactly. Wow, okay, well maybe I will not finish my point. I want to talk a little bit about the importance of contexts and how particularly these very complex, these long-standing issues, 30-year conflicts. By the way, next year, 2017, is going to be the 30th anniversary of the LRA, or the Holy Spirit Movement too, as it was first known at the time. So that's something that obviously gets, you know, forgotten or neglected, particularly in these very long conflicts. But there is definitely a reason why groups like the LRA come to the fore, why they exist. They don't sort of grow out of nothing, out of vacuum. And And the more these problems fester and go unaddressed, I think the longer these problems, they will continue, and they are unlikely to go away, as we also might see with other groups like Boko Haram or even Al-Shabaab. And in the case of the LRA, there were, and now these have been documented, you know, abuses by the then rebel group, which was led by the then rebel leader, Yoweri Museveni, who is now the president of Uganda, and they were never really been addressed. I think that's important that after all these years, there is still some recognition of the fact that the Acholi population was targeted not only by the LRA mercilessly, particularly sort of like after the early to mid 90s when the Sudanese armed forces supported the LRA and turned it into a legitimate force, but before that as well by the forces of the National Resistance Movement, which then became the sort of de facto Ugandan army. And I think that's something that, particularly to all students here, students of conflict, is something that It's very important to keep in mind anytime you talk about a conflict or any sort of like difficult situation, that nothing really comes, just happens out of nowhere. And again, go back to the criticism of Cohen 2012, that exactly, I think, is exactly what was missing. And what was worse, it's something that played, or rather continued, the sort of a line that usually the government of the Ugandan government had, or Ugandan army officers sometimes unwittingly had furthered this idea that the Northerners were this unruly sort of martial group, again based on English sort of colonial thinking, and therefore they needed to be responded to by violence, and they were also, and that the UPDF, the Ugandan army, was what stopped the crazy Northerners from coming into the South and sort of destroying them. So using therefore the LRA as for political reasons, and I think that's very important to be able to distinguish why these sort of attacks or why this line of thing has happened. This is pretty much it. I think the book, the thing I was going to say is that it's written in a sort of simple style for two reasons. Partly because I recently learned English, so I'm still working on it. And second, I wanted to maintain that sort of matter-of-factly tone that the informant, as it were, if you're sort of into anthropology, in this case George, maintained or talked to me about when he recounted his story, which was sort of direct and to the point, without a lot of sort of emotion, at least at first, with sort of emotional tone to it, partly because in many ways it attested to the way life was in the LRA, and it was pretty much a difficult life, and it was a daily struggle to survive. That included often killing other people to take their food. So, but I think that it's, and I've been told that it is readable, and that it's not necessarily academic or sort of hard to digest. But this is just the reason why the style is as such. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. So I'll just pass over to Tim now to sort of offer some reflections and thoughts, maybe for about 10 minutes or so.
Maybe not, now that we've got four on the panel. It's kind of interesting that you think of as academic as hard to digest. Yeah. I mean, the book is actually very easy to digest. It's a very, very readable book, and it's a very compelling, rather harrowing account in many ways. Partly because you do an amazing job at making somebody who is doing atrocious things quite reasonable. And you can see how, if you like, it could be any of us drawn into that situation. I think that's, in a way, what's so compelling about it. We were together in at a meeting in Brussels yesterday, and there were a couple of things I was really kind of interested about that meeting. I mean, a very different sort of audience to the ones that, I'm not sure whoever's here at the back there, but there were a lot of people at the Brussels meeting, working for the European Union and working for international agencies and so on. And I thought some of the questions were fascinating. It's like, the conundrum for most of them was, well, how could this small group have kept, at the peak, 1.5 million people in dreadful circumstances in displacement camps in northern Uganda. How was that possible that they could be so effective at terrifying? And it was remarkable how little understanding of how this situation in northern Uganda had emerged, even from rather senior people. The fact that those displacement camps in northern Uganda were to a large extent constructed by international aid agencies, that humanitarian organizations kept them running, that international agencies, including the European Union, who one of the participants yesterday was representing at the time, was fully supportive of Museveni's government, and basically international aid was drawn into ferocious anti-insurgency operations for years and years and years. And I think there's some really worrying issues for us to think about with respect to northern Uganda. And one of the issues that several of us have been working on over the last few years is, you know, what has happened to these people who were taken by the LRA? Many of them children, not all of them children by any means, but thousands of children. And we know that about 30,000 people who were taken as children have returned to northern Uganda. Either they escaped, or they were released, or they were captured by the Ugandan army, and they came back through northern Uganda. And at the time that I started working in that region again in 2004, when the camps were, if you like, at their height, there were hundreds and hundreds of these camps in northern Uganda, with, I'd say, 1.5 million people, living in appalling circumstances. I mean, the worst that I have ever seen in all my years of working on humanitarian disasters, with crude mortality rates that you would expect in, you know, the most extreme humanitarian crisis. And these were being kept there and maintained by the Ugandan authorities together with humanitarian organizations. And that was really a shocking thing to see. But there were other aspects of it that I found in some ways even more shocking. These thousands of children that were coming back bit by bit over many years came back through reception centers. They were given a few weeks of psychosocial support, and they were then taken out and dumped in these displacement camps that were too dangerous to visit, apart from a few hours in the middle of the day, and left there and not followed up. And then agencies would go back into Gulu town, and there was a great nightlife, even at the height of the war. You could have quite a nice time as an aid worker in Gulu town. But it was a kind of bubble. It was so separated from the world outside. And we had, of course, all the publicity about the invisible children. But, I mean, the most striking characteristic of the invisible children is that they were the visible ones. They were the ones that walked into Gulu town at night and could be filmed. But there were hundreds of thousands, millions, actually, hundreds of thousands, to say, children living out in these camps, in the dark at night, and not only being victims to the LRA, but other groups as well, including groups associated with the Ugandan authorities. And there was just almost like no interest in what was happening to them. There were more than 60 agencies working on HIV/AIDS in Gulu town. But at that time, people were not dying of AIDS. They were dying of cholera and infectious diseases in the camps. It was horrific to see it. People were living in their own excrement. And so that extraordinary level of cognitive dissonance and disengagement shocked me very deeply. The fact that I went out there in 2004 during the war with support. I was funded by an international agency who wanted me to look at their programs apart from anything else. One of the first things they said to me is, oh, you can't actually go and sleep in the camps. You can only go and visit them in the middle of the day and come back into the town. And I said, that's absurd. How am I going to know what's going on in these places unless I can go and research it? So we had to kind of drop below the radar, so to speak, and go and spend time in the camps. And it was really shocking to see what happened in those camps at night. And so you have this enormous sort of fantastical invasion of humanitarian agencies stuck in the towns, not engaged with the population as a whole. And then, you know, in Brussels yesterday, we were asked, you know, how was it sustained for so long? And the answer, of course, is partly because, you know, nobody was speaking, if you like, you know, truth to reality. It wasn't as though it was hiding. You only had to go to those camps to see what was going on. It wasn't difficult to see it, but there was an extraordinary capacity not to see. And so I was very struck, you know, in these discussions yesterday, how people still sort of ask these questions and are kind of surprised that this war has gone on for so long. Another aspect of it, which I think has been alluded to in what you've said, is that, I mean, the LRA, partly because there's no question that the LRA have done some shockingly barbaric, I think is a reasonable word, shockingly barbaric things, cutting off lips, cutting off ears. They are a terrorist organisation in all sorts of ways. But that, of course, has also been very helpful for the government of Uganda. You know, I lived in Uganda in the early 1980s, so I have no illusions of what life was like before President Museveni took over. I went to Luwero and I saw piled up corpses in Luwero in the early 1980s. When I first was in Kampala, people were getting shot in the streets at night. There's no question that under President Museveni, Uganda has come very far. And the development, if that's what it is, in much of the country has been quite remarkable. But there's been this other side to it, that very efficiency in absorbing international aid was also turned into this horrendous anti-insurgency operation, which actually became part of the aid programs, I would argue. It was the other side of those programs. So I think if we want to understand how and why this situation lasted so long, we have to look at who benefited from it and what the political context was in which it occurred. There are also many remarkable things about the book, not least that the protagonist, George, joined the LRA voluntarily. Of course, the idea is everybody was abducted, but we have found very many people who were, who joined the LRA, in effect. Many people who said they were abducted, and then you ask them, well, what happened when you were abducted? And then they said, which time? And then they start telling you, oh, you were abducted 10 times. And then once someone's been abducted 10 times, you might think, well, there's a different sort of abduction's not quite the right word. Inevitably, people had to live with the LRA in this region. But Lydia was an interesting character. I mean, so Lydia, your protagonist, was an interesting character in that, yeah, I'm thinking about you because you write the book. He obviously comes from a family where there was quite a lot of support for the LRA anyway and to resistance against Museveni's government. And he joined the LRA during the peace processes. I mean, he was even flown to join the LRA by the United Nations. So there's some really sort of bizarre sort of twists in this story. And it also works really well with Matt's book. I mean, in a way, they're both, I think it's fair to say, written in a journalistic. So I'm talking as an academic now. You say academic work is, can't be.
You use that word as if it's some sort of.
Yeah, I know. But he did. Now, the academic, so it's a bit journalistic-y. Well, it is a bit journalistic-y, like Matt's book, but I thought Matt's book was great, and I think this book's great. I mean, they take us into a world which an academic book, a normal academic book, finds hard to do, and what they have both done is they've been true to their materials and use their creativity to bring it alive to people who haven't been in those places. And so I'm a great admirer of both of these books. And now I'm going to hand over to you.
And I really love your books. All of your books. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to pass over to Matt now.
Ten minutes?
Yeah.
There's so much to say. We can freestyle. It's almost taking me back in my own mind hearing these conversations, because I was doing my research into the LRA in 2005, 2006, at the time of the Juba talks. And my book is based on my journey to try to meet Joseph Kony, and on the way understand, really answer this question that was being asked at this meeting: how could this conflict go on for so long? How could one man leading an army of child soldiers hold half a country hostage? Well, as Tim points out, it turns out that actually he didn't. It's a lot more complicated than that. And I think the points you were making about the complicity of the aid industry with this brutal counterinsurgency strategy that was pursued by the Ugandan military is very important and hasn't received certainly enough journalistic scrutiny. I was a journalist at the time working for Reuters based in Nairobi, and I remember we would get the press releases coming in from the World Food Programme saying we need more money to feed these poor people in these camps in northern Uganda. And they had a very, very charismatic press officer in Nairobi, who I was always happy to write up her press release and, you know, send it on its way to the outside world, appealing for funds. But it was only when I really stepped out of my day job and had a chance to hang around and ask these questions that I saw what Tim was describing. And I think was it Chris Dolan who talked about doctors being complicit in torture by keeping a torture victim alive? And it almost felt a bit like that. That there seemed to be a huge disconnect between what was happening on the ground and the political pressure that could have been put on Museveni. And I think to agree with your argument, but to zoom out, I think it's very important to remember the bigger political context in East Africa at that time. It wasn't that long ago since Rwanda had been plunged into genocide. There was the rumbling war in eastern Congo. There was a war going on between, essentially an undeclared war between Uganda and Sudan, with the LRA serving as a proxy for the Sudanese military. So there were much bigger geopolitical forces in play that meant it was very convenient for the internationals to basically turn a blind eye to Museveni, hand the money over, and hope this whole problem would go away, and really accept the government's narrative, and not look too deeply at those deeper drivers of the conflict, the historical and social factors that were prolonging the war. Now, there's so much that can be said on this. I'm going to speak very briefly on the point about victims and perpetrators. I spent a lot of time researching my book, speaking to a young LRA fighter called Moses, who was abducted from the Samuel Baker Secondary School one night when I think they took 139 boys. They just smashed the door. The rebels came, smashed the doors down, and took this huge group. And it was a very famous incident in the north. Samuel Baker, of course, being the great Victorian explorer who charted Acholiland for the first time, really, was one of the first British explorers to really chart the region. And so even his name kind of hints at the colonial history as well, which is really vital in understanding the current dynamics, or certainly the dynamics that drove the conflict. But Moses was very much a victim, kidnapped at 16. But he spent 8 years in the Lord's Resistance Army. And what I found so surprising, and I'm sure you would have found the same, Nadia, was almost a sense of pride about serving in the rebel ranks. He spent 8 years before he finally escaped, and he was promoted. He was a lieutenant. The LRA runs on the same rank structure as the British Army. And they're an incredibly disciplined fighting force. You talked about the fact that no one drinks alcohol, no smoking. They would go on these incredible route marches through the bush. And they were really good at what they did. They were superb guerrillas. So Moses, I mean, of course, he knew that 8 years of his life had been stolen. But there was always this strange inner conflict that I observed in him between almost a sense of nostalgia, the pride of any young man who's proved himself in battle, but also this knowledge that he had been implicated, involved in these horrific crimes. But certainly very paradoxical, I think, and certainly more paradoxical than the many of the portrayals that we see in the media. So much to be said on this, but I'm going to make a final point on Kony 2012. Now, I'll probably be alone in this room in saying that actually, I think what Kony 2012 did was pretty remarkable. When you think about it, I remember meeting those five guys. I think there's a small group of them, Invisible Children. I didn't know them, but I think I briefly met them years ago in Gulu. And whatever you think of the content of the video and all the questions it raises, the fact that they were practically single-handedly put this conflict on the map in the way that they did, compared to all the years of lobbying by Oxfam and WFP and all these NGOs and journalists, I think it is pretty incredible. And I'm not sure quite what to think about it, but I think that it deserves more consideration than I think we need to ask what it says about the power of activism in the age of social media and what that could imply for the future. As well as, you know, pointing out the obvious flaws in what they produced. So plenty more to say on that, but I'll hand the mic back over to people who are actually probably much more qualified than me.
Thank you, Matt. And Fred, would you
like to also make some comments, yeah.
Yes, thank you for those comments made. Ultimately, one of the big things that we're dealing with in Uganda is the fact that, especially when we look at Kony 2016, is that the conflict has gone through very much at least six iterations or mutations, if you want to call it that. We're talking about a conflict that began, you know, very much in 1986, which is very much a conflict of political transition in Uganda when Museveni was taking over, which then mutated into a proxy war between Sudan and Uganda, as you said, you know, with both supporting each other's insurgencies. Then, that was in 94. Then in 2001, it's subsumed into the war on terror, with Uganda becoming a frontline state against Sudan. Then in 2004, it becomes international justice with the ICC involvement, and it's about atrocity and child soldiers, etc. Then 2010, it becomes the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. Then 2012, it becomes an international conflict, which is very much now where it is today. And so one of the problems when I talk to people on the ground is that we are on several levels. We are trying to resolve a 1986 conflict in 2016, which has mutated and changed in so many ways, with new actors turning up, new ideas, new fears, new worries, etc. And so that's one of the big issues I see, especially with, we call it, yes, a 30-year conflict, but so much has happened that is irreversible in that. So that's just one of the first things I wanted to know. Another thing which I really came to see in northern Uganda, I mean, I was there just last year, is that peace happens when the level of violence becomes acceptable. Violence never stops in conflicts. Violence never ends. It is reduced to becoming a policing problem, where it doesn't impact on the political system, because what I've seen is that the violence in northern Uganda, well, the LRA and Joseph Kony has become virtually irrelevant in Uganda. Museveni is primarily concerned with his survival and regime stability. The biggest threat to Museveni is from the south, is from the opposition, is from the Baganda and the Kabaka. You're finding that the conflict in northern Uganda has ended in the sense that it's become irrelevant. You know, if Kony kills people in the CAR, then so be it. We really couldn't care less. And so, as I said, yeah, the LRA, you know, it almost has no real, people don't feel threatened by the LRA, by this phantom that can appear at any moment, in the way that they did in the 1990s and the 2000s. That's one of the second big thing I noticed. Also, what I found was that there are a lot of parallels between the LRA and the RUF in Sierra Leone. You found that these were groups that killed off the intelligentsia very early on in their insurgencies, leaving these almost, I don't want to say illiterate peasants, who basically had no real, well, became a quasi-terrorist rebellion, had no real agenda, no real political idea, although they had the grievances from the 80s, but instead, you know, almost had the same trajectory where, you know, the RUF became infamous because of mutilation, because of child abduction, and that's why the whole world went against it, but in a different way that they were finally defeated. Another interesting factor is the fact that it's not so much the LRA successes or even the humanitarian economy that developed, which is very lucrative, but also the institutional dysfunction of the UPDF. Something which I noticed a lot in my master's research, where you found that the UPDF has been strategically and purposely debilitated by the regime, coup-proofing primarily. The high level of ghost soldiers, the untrained soldiers, lack of equipment. You're finding that the UPDF for a long time has not been able to actually engage the LRA. Soldiers would run away rather than face the LRA. I have internal reports from the Ministry of Defense where soldiers and NCOs would complain about the lack of resources, how rebels are on our toes and we haven't got anything. We haven't got any bullets. We're seeing our comrades die in the field and their bodies are rotting. We can't actually help them. And so I think the institution, this dysfunction, has a lot to say in terms of why the LRA themselves were able to do what they were able to do. One thing that has really emerged, especially from 2009 to the present, as I said, is that for a long time, the NRM regime and Museveni were the donor darling of the West. Museveni was seen as the poster child for speaking out against HIV, for embracing neoliberal reform, and also becoming an American partner in the front in the war on terror. And so for the West, all of Museveni's misdeeds, they would turn a blind eye, because as far as they were concerned, he was only one of the only regimes, especially in East Africa, that they could trust. So many of the neighbors were in serious, serious problems. However, and so the war was functional in the sense that it allowed Museveni to rally the South, to rally the Bantu South around himself. However, there was a shift around 2009 to the present, whereby the South started turning against Museveni. People started questioning the lack of reform, the lack of services. You had challenges such as Walk to Work, Activists for Change, growing opposition in the form of the FDC and the DP parties. And so you started seeing that Museveni started realizing, hold on a second, the South is turning against me. And suddenly the camps and the war in the North was no longer functional. The camps started to become an embarrassment. And all of a sudden now, the North has now shifted to become Museveni's stronghold, Museveni's base. You're seeing, you know, the camps were told were closed down very, very quickly. Peace was restored. The rhetoric was about, you know, I brought peace, you know, I ended the violence, and now the North is my friend. And so the NRM support base has shifted from South to North. And you can see now how this, almost the war has vanished from public discourse. Instead, it's all about NRM success in bringing about peace in the North. And when you talk to people on the ground, they're like, you know, you don't cause problems, solve them, and then claim to be the savior. That's very much the rhetoric around a lot of the people in northern Uganda. And so what I'm really seeing, and so this is just some points I'm noticing in terms of how the conflict has evolved and where what are the real issues now in Uganda, which are more to do with regime survival, almost dynastic democracy with Museveni wanting to hand over to his son and trying to maintain the support base in the South. Also linked to that is the fact that, as many know, that you know the discovery of oil in the North also made northern Uganda very, very lucrative. And so you couldn't have a war going on with people in camps dying of cholera and disease and starvation when oil exploration needs to go on. And the fact that Museveni, you know, a couple of years ago said, you know, this is my oil. You know, not the nation's oil, but my oil. Which raised a few eyebrows. But I'll stop there, I think.
Thank you very much. And thank you for agreeing to talk at very short notice. It's brilliant to have you here. I'm going to now open up to the floor for questions. But I just, maybe before I do that, actually, we could just perhaps ask Lydia to respond to some of the issues that have been raised here. And also, if you wouldn't mind, I think maybe if we could bring it back to this question of Kony 2016. And it would be really interesting to hear your thoughts, your analysis on where the LRA is at today. What is the LRA today? What does it look like? What kind of future does the LRA have? What kind of problems is it creating in the countries where it's operational? And so your thoughts on that would be, I think, very valuable at this stage. And then we'll open up the floor for questions. Thanks.
Thank you. First, I guess, to some of the commonalities, that some of the things that we agree on. Thank you, Matt and Fred, for... You clearly got the Blazer memo. You're on the same page here. That's awesome. So on the point of Kony 2012, since we talk about this, I know those guys well, and I respect them, and I respect particularly the way that the group is run right now. I'm very good friends with the young woman who runs the organization now. They're doing a great job. But I disagree with the fact that what they did was amazing. I think it was very... in many ways, a sort of PR campaign that could have had any product and would have made it very successful, I think. Sadly, it wasn't my book, but it could have been that. And the reason why I say that is, and I don't really, and it brought attention, but I'm not sure that it brought that much attention that already didn't exist there. And the reason why I say that is, by 2012, you had a... President Obama who had signed the LRA bill already by 2009, and you had U.S. special forces on the ground already. And sometimes I think people ask me this, like, you know, well, Kony 2012 brought about the U.S. involvement. No, it was after. But I agree with your point that activism was important, because the same people that made Kony 2012 were some of the main sort of people behind the movement to have the U.S. Strategy be passed with bipartisan support, as well as then all this money that was spent. And this brings me to where we are now. Well, about $1 billion has been spent on a military effort to deal with the LRA since the U.S. Decided to go after the LRA in support of the Ugandan army, based out of, among other places, Entebbe in Uganda, as well as Nzara in South Sudan, Obo in CAR, and Dungu in DRC. Most of the money goes towards fancy equipment, trying to figure out where the LRA groups are, and doing a lot of sort of surveillance and things like that. I don't know all of that because it's classified information, but that's a lot of giving airlifts to Ugandan troops that are supposed to go out there and trying to go after the LRA, after LRA groups. There are maybe 6 or 7 LRA groups, very small, 20 or 30. That are scattered around most of, in many areas in eastern CAR and northeastern DRC, and in this place called Kafiakinju, which is in southern Darfur, a disputed territory between the two Sudans, right on the border with CAR. And Kony has been there for a while. He has been sending troops to kill elephants in Garamba Park in Congo and bring tusks to where he is. And then same for other groups who go and get artisanal miners and loot their diamonds and gold, bring it back to Kony, and Kony's sons exchange them for things like ammunition and food primarily. There are about, I think, 80 or so Ugandan LRA fighters that I think that constitutes the backbone of the LRA, because they are the ones in command positions, and they are the ones that are not, have been unable to go home because it's far and for many other reasons, some of them also that Matthew mentioned. And but they continue to abduct. The groups, can, even though in small number, I keep saying they're a multiplying force. They tend to multiply their terror. I mean, they do use sort of terror methods. They I think there were about 300 abductions for the first 6 months of 2016, which is remarkable for a group that's supposed to sort of be to disappearing soon. I think thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of displaced people, certainly in CAR, certainly in DRC as well, in South Sudan. And sporadic killings, but nevertheless, killings happen. And I think perhaps a very worrying fact is that there have been a lot of copycats attacks now, copycats group, particularly in DRC, where you get this really strange attacks that people attribute to the LRA, but you know, if you know how the LRA operates, they seem weird. They're not in their modus operandi. So, and that problem is going to continue, I think, even after Kony is gone, which leads to an important point that these areas suffer from sort of conflicts and that might easily outlive Kony. So hopefully, not only will Kony be dealt with, but I'm hoping that particularly the U.S. involvement will create sort of more tangible benefits for the civilians in the areas. Doesn't really bode well that while there $1 billion has been spent on the military effort, only about $20 or $30 million have been spent on the humanitarian effort. So, you know, one of the things I'm hoping the book will create is more attention and more need and more support for the humanitarian effort in these areas.
Thank you. Okay, I'll take some questions now, maybe in sort of groups of three. Does anyone have any questions they'd like to address to the speakers? Okay, so just start at the back there, please. If you could just say your name and where you're from.
My name is Elsa, and I'm doing a master's in the International Development Department here at NSC. And I wanted to touch upon the topic between the blurry lines between victims and perpetrators. And I'd like to know your thoughts on the ICC warrant against Kony, and whether you think justice can ever be achieved if there is such a blurry line between victims and perpetrators.
Okay, thank you. Yeah?
I'm from an African sitting fellow at the Center for Human Rights. Given that your last call there is for more humanitarian assistance, more attention to humanitarian assistance, and Tim Allen's points about how humanitarian assistance was diverted essentially
interest in the counter-terror operation, how would you recommend that that assistance would be better used? What should be the steps taken? And I think that would be a relevant mobility. For example, in northern Nigeria, Boko Haram, where you've got tens of thousands of people at risk of starvation, and not a huge humanitarian exercise. But one could also imagine that a humanitarian response could play into counter-terror operations in the same way. Are there general lessons that could be taken from that?
Yeah.
Jordan Anderson from IHS James. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the prospects for a limited resurgence of the LRA following the withdrawal of the guidance from the task force.
Okay, so there's three questions there on all slightly different issues. So the role of the ICC in delivering justice in northern Uganda, given the complexity of the sort of victim-perpetrator and that moral grey zone that many people occupy. The role of humanitarian assistance, given some of the critiques of humanitarian assistance in northern Uganda during the conflict. And then prospects for resurgence, given the withdrawal from the regional task force of the UPDF. Should we go this way? Tim, do you want to address any of those questions?
How do you do better humanitarian work in these places? Well, I guess that's why many of you are studying it here at the LSE and why we try to teach it. It's not straightforward. I suppose what I found most disturbing about observing humanitarians in this part of Africa was the cognitive dissonance, as I mentioned. And I think, I didn't complete my story about the 30,000 odd children that came back. They were left in those camps and never followed up. So at one point we found, in 2005, we found something like 30,000 records. We actually had 10,000 in a World Vision Center, 8,000 in another center funded by Save the Children. Detailed records of these children who'd come back from the LRA just being kind of dumped in a corner. And there was no follow-up. Then 10 years later, we tried to find some of them in 2005. 10 years later, we've been able to do much more systematic follow-up, trying to find them. But most of the records have just been destroyed. We found about 3,500, and we've taken a sample, and we're tracking them down. And it is an incredibly difficult job to find them. And they have never been followed up. So I suppose, I can't give you a complete answer to your question about better humanitarian responses, but the extraordinary levels of humanitarian impunity, the lack of responsibility for actions. Where else in the world would you take responsibility for clearly traumatized children, and your policy is to dump them in camps that are too dangerous to visit, and then you never go and find out if they're still alive? I mean, it's so extreme, you almost couldn't make it up. So, the first thing is that there needs to be some kind of accountability within the humanitarian system. And to be fair, it's often humanitarians who tell that story. I mean, who broke the news on the mortality rates in the camps? It was MSF, actually. And a large-scale study that was in the end funded by the World Health Organization. So you can find allies within the system. There are people who will, if you like, break the mold and talk about these things. But we have this system that's funded through a kind of constant public relations exercise, as Matt was alluding to, that is not based on evidence. It's based on, what is the product of the humanitarian agencies? It's not actually, in many cases, assistance to impoverished, suffering people. It's a package that donors will fund. And that's an absolutely fundamental problem. I mean, since I've written a book on the International Criminal Court, and I'm still very involved with the Criminal Court, I suppose I should touch upon that question too. I mean, I'm an anthropologist, and I've worked in this part of Africa for a very long time, and I've seen some really terrible things. And really, for most of my career working in this part of Africa, no one's really cared very much. Not really. I mean, sometimes there's a bit of news somewhere, but it doesn't get picked up and followed. There has been generally a view, not just internationally, but I think even in these places themselves, amongst political leaders, that the people in this part of the world don't count as much as other people. That you can kill 500,000 people here and it doesn't really matter as much as 100 people dying in a train crash in France. And I think the importance of the criminal court, despite all the huge problems with it, is it has brought the gaze of the world to this place in a new way. And it has given people the possibility of arguing that they count too. Not necessarily in the specific cases of the court, but the fact that it's created a debate about it. You can now have a conversation with people about it in a way that you couldn't in the past. Is the International Criminal Court providing justice to this region? You know, only in a very, very marginal way. Of course, it's deeply compromised justice. And the Ong Weng case, the court's prosecuting someone who was himself a victim of the crime he's being prosecuted for. He was abducted as a child and inculcated into a strange moral universe where behaving in the way that he did, and it was horrific sometimes from all the evidence, was somehow normal. But do I think it's a good idea to hold someone like that to account in the way that the Nazis were held to account after the Second World War? I think, broadly speaking, yes, I do. It's symbolic, but it's a kind of line in the sand, and for me, it's worth doing, and I say that as an anthropologist who's interested in different notions of justice and accountability. It seems to me that having that approach in this part of the world is of value, despite all the problems associated with implementing criminal justice in this way.
Yes, please.
So the ICC question. Yes, I think I agree with Professor Allen that the ICC is an important mechanism. It should definitely do its job. I don't think that there is necessarily an issue of sort of duality of perpetrator and victim when it comes to Kony necessarily. So I wouldn't have any issues with that as many as I have with someone like Ong Nguyen, who, right as Professor Allen rightly said, is exactly sort of the embodiment of what is deeply tragic about this whole thing, which is that you have sort of stolen childhoods and livelihoods, and then you have these very complex situations where it's very hard to feel optimistic that any sense of justice will prevail in the end, whether Ong Nguyen gets sent to prison for life or if he comes out. It's been a tragedy all around. I wish the ICC had also taken a role into looking into the Ugandan army sort of abuses in northern Uganda, and in that way, maybe a better sense of accountability would have ensued, but I'm hoping that at least if Ong Nguyen gets his day in court and he gets to sort of make his own narrative and tell his own story in his own words, maybe that would be a good, at least something to look forward to. Second question, the assistant, right? The humanitarian assistant. Yeah. So, no, it's a very important point, and I personally have asked for and continue to push for the American soldiers who are left there to actually use the so-called sort of military money, that part that it goes to things like intelligence and so on, to use that for less sort of belligerent strategy, and that practically means DDR, like the sort of demobilization and reintegration, encouraging people to come out, spending more of that money on leaflets, messaging, on radio, making sure that people can get safely home, as well as more sort of practical benefits like building a road. There is this road that sort of broken my back trying to cross from, trying to drive on that road from South Sudan to this town in CAR that has been destroyed in large part by Ugandan trucks bringing Ugandan army and U.S., mostly Ugandan army, sort of war material, and the farmers cannot take their produce to South Sudan, for instance, and they cannot move very well. So things of that nature, I think, would be important to have some tangible benefits. And on a more humanitarian sort of aspect, there is a lot of need for support for people and communities that were affected by the LRA, and in northern Uganda, as well as in all these other countries. And I think, unlike the situation in the past when the IDP camps, there, at least in northern Uganda and also in some of these other parts, there isn't much of a state to speak of that can perhaps sort of hijack the any international aid that comes in. So perhaps maybe this is an opportunity for some NGOs, hopefully with very little overhead cost, to actually go and do some work. Or there are already a couple of groups working. It always amazes me to go to these sort of remote areas and find like a sort of lonely Italian woman sort of with a big bag of pasta and olive oil and living there for forever and trying to make to help, or other people as well that, you know, really believe in what they're doing, which I think is great. So that kind of efforts we need to support, especially the local communities as well. Local NGOs are doing a lot of good work as well, and they are often the ones that do most of the hard work and get the least of the money, because of course they have to partner with international organizations. So I think some of those groups exist. I think some of the groups have been working against all odds, and all they need is actually a little bit more money, to be honest. One of the things that I'm doing as sort of part of this effort to raise awareness is to make sure that when I talk to donors, I have a list of local organizations that receive money directly with very little sort of money going to overhead or transactional costs. I can talk more about that if you want, sort of like more give names later, I suppose. And the third question was? I keep thinking that 30th anniversary, for some reason, will just be it. 30 years seems like a really long time. It'll be a sort of nice, maybe poetic way to end it, and maybe all be done. I don't know why, I think, but there is a chance that the LRA will continue, there might be a resurgence. And actually, that's a good point that you brought up. Yes, the Ugandan army has said that they're going to withdraw. Rather, President Museveni has said that they're going to withdraw, and if the Ugandans withdraw, then the Americans will have to withdraw as well, because the American strategy is based primarily as being an assistant to the Ugandan army. I've been saying that the Americans should stay regardless of what the Ugandans do, because precisely the Americans can do things like sort of more peaceful approaches to the conflict, like DDR, leaflets and all that. So the Ugandans are going to withdraw. I know there have been threats now. They've been threatening 2 or 3 years now in a row, especially when there had been criticism from the American embassy in Kampala towards President Museveni and the government. But this time it seems like they are serious and it's going to happen. It was supposed to happen in October. Then it was postponed till December. It might actually go on till later. Of course, you know, with Mr. Trump in the picture, I mean, all bets are off, I guess. So maybe we'll all move to Obor, you know, CAR, after, you know, I'm certainly thinking about it. Tirana is suddenly an impressive prospect. They could certainly do that. So far, the LRA certainly has been focusing on maintaining the Ugandan base support for command positions and not abducting, or rather not putting awarding ranks to non-Ugandans. So therefore, they haven't grown very much, because the non-Ugandans tend to get killed first and also not stay. But that might change, and certainly if the army withdraws, then there would be a security vacuum, and that possibly could happen. I can't rule it out.
Thank you. Brad?
Yes, I just want to comment on a few points. The first one on humanitarianism. It's very important to see and understand what humanitarians actually do, because many of us think that they're there simply to feed people, to save them from disease, to provide them with shelter, water, etc. and that when they don't do that, we see it as a failure. Whereas rather than looking at what they should be doing, we should almost look at what they actually do. And what you found in northern Uganda is that, and this is something which Alex Duval talks about, especially in Darfur, is that there's been almost this rapid and traumatic urbanization that has taken place because of the camps. A similar thing happened in Darfur, where 35% of the population was urbanized in Nyala because of the conflict. And that has a lasting effect. People cannot just simply go home after many years. You find that it has changed livelihoods, it has changed communities, it has changed expectations. And while we may think that humanitarians suddenly, when they do bad things and then they stop, that everything can be reset back to zero. And so what you find is that, especially in northern Uganda, is that many of the camps are becoming semi-permanent settlements. You're almost seeing this almost like urbanization taking place, which no one's really talking about, but it's kind of like it's there, and you just have to live with it. And you find that a lot of humanitarian organizations, what they bring actually is the livelihoods and the raised expectations. They bring, for example, like you had all these humanitarian organizations in northern Uganda, and the impact it was having was that apart from the structural violence they were creating, they were also bringing jobs. They were also, you know, bringing the rental price higher. They were bringing the food price higher. You go to northern Uganda, the lasting effect of the humanitarian crisis has been a higher cost of living for the ordinary people. Because a humanitarian could turn up and take a hotel at premium price, three times the price, and it was fine. They could pay three times the price for anything. And this is what it leaves behind in its wake. And that's what the people actually have to deal with. And so that's just something which we have to remember, that humanitarianism is not just simply about the relief aid. There are far longer consequences in these zones of instability. On the issue of the ICC and justice, I was in Uganda in 2011, and there was a notorious LRA commander called Koyelo who was put on trial in Uganda, and he was acquitted and found not guilty precisely because he had been a child soldier. And this guy was absolutely ruthless. And for many of the families, it became legal fiction. They could not believe that this guy, who was an adult now, walked free. And so you're seeing this sense of anger and animosity in northern Uganda, which is interesting because Acholis don't forgive. They'll keep things in their heart and they'll live with them for a time. But they will always have it with them. And when the opportunity comes, all hell could break loose. You know, you're seeing when I was there, you could see that people had kind of, they were wearing masks and a facade that, you know, fine, this is the situation, I'm going to live with it, you know. And so underneath the surface of justice and stability, I feel that things are boiling, basically, in northern Uganda. In addition to that, we also have to understand that if you look at the ICC involvement, and it's something which I came to realize recently from a lawyer in Uganda, he said that the ICC were involved in 2004. And it's surprising because when Uganda was embroiled in the DRC war in 98, the DRC actually took Uganda to the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, and for war crimes, basically, for invading them and looting the place. And the verdict came out in 2003, and it was actually against the Ugandan government. The Ugandan government were basically charged with war crimes. And for them, inviting the ICC into Uganda was a way to try and shield their own war crimes. And it worked very well, because people don't remember, have no discussion about what the Ugandan government did in the DRC. And so it's really interesting, this idea of, you know, who's justice, what justice, justice from whose perspective, etc. Just another point I wanted to make is the issue of, in relation to the ICC, is the fact that it's been relabeled, you know, the European Court for Africa. Because if you look at all the people that have been prosecuted, they're all Africans. And people are asking, well, is this basically neocolonialism? You know, will Bush and Blair ever face trial for what they did in Iraq? Will Putin ever face trial for, you know, the downing of the Malaysian airline, you know? And so everyone's turning around and saying, well, is this basically just a one big bureaucracy that's sucking up all this funding, similar to the ICTR, which spent $300 million and only tried 90 cases? Where is all this money going? Who is getting it? Is it just another bureaucracy that exists for itself? You know, there's a famous saying that when it comes to understanding UN bureaucracies is that the way the mill operates is more important than the quality of the flour it produces, in the sense that these bureaucracies create their own discourses and exist for themselves, basically. It's about salaries, the benefits, etc. Final point is this issue of ultimately where is this all going and why should we even care? Because ultimately what we're seeing here is symptoms of much bigger problems of state formation, state consolidation, state presence, the role of these countries in the global economy, basically highly contested national identities in zones of scarcity, feudal pre-industrial societies, much bigger questions which about what, who and what is the state, ultimately. And it's always important to keep that in focus. You know, what is the Ugandan state and who is the Ugandan state, ultimately? I'll pause it.
Thanks. Well, I'll just add a very brief footnote. First of all, it's a pretty remarkable figure, isn't it, that $1 billion spent by the US military to not capture 80 armed rebels. I mean, I thought I'd seen a waste of money in Afghanistan, but that is pretty impressive. On the ICC, I was quite moved by your defence, Tim, since you've been one of the court's greatest critics over the years. But I think I agree, and I'll just add the footnote. It's obvious, isn't it, reading Tim's work, what a mess, particularly Luis Moreno Ocampo, made of launching the prosecutions against the LRA. I think he appeared at a press conference, didn't he, with Yoweri Museveni, which is hardly going to convey the impression that this is a neutral institution. And I was conducting my own research, trying to meet Kony at that time when the Juba peace talks were taking place, and I joined these convoys going out into the bush in the Garamba National Park. Took 3 days to get there, flying in these rickety aircraft, driving in these 4x4s through mud roads, finally arriving at this clearing. And a huge delegation had assembled in one of the most remote places I've ever been. And Joseph Kony was somewhere in a bush within 100 metres, but he refused to come out. And one of the reasons that was given, of course, was that he was worried about being arrested. I wasn't about to perform a citizen's arrest on him, I can assure you. Probably wouldn't have been a very good idea. But it was clearly a huge sticking point. And at that time, the TV was showing pictures of Charles Taylor, the former Liberian president and warlord, being extradited to the special court for Sierra Leone. So there was clearly that fear in the rebel delegation's mind about what the ICC indictments would mean. But I'd also add, I don't think that's what tipped it. I don't think that was the real factor. I think the leadership of the LRA was so paranoid that in some ways it was quite a useful excuse to be internationally wanted. I don't think they would have come out regardless.
Thank you. We've got time for one more round of questions. Yeah, Jorge at the back, and here. So we'll start with you. Yeah. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Olivia. I'm an MSc student on human rights at the LSE. And my question is on the child
what mechanisms, or are there any mechanisms in place now for the sort of the rehabilitation of people that have been, say, abducted, or people that have joined the NRA and are now facing back to go back to their communities?
Okay, thank you. So three big questions there. There's the very big question about the Juba talks and why they failed, essentially. A really interesting question about, well, in fact, these two interrelate, really. This is about what kind of processes, mechanisms, institutions there are in place to reintegrate people that have been in the Lord's Resistance Army. Some of them have been back for a very long time, others more recently. And also the broader question about the social fabric in northern Uganda, in essentially post-conflict northern Uganda. The LRA has pretty much been, the war was pretty much exported from kind of 2006 onwards. There haven't been any major attacks. We don't have a huge amount of time, so you might have to be slightly briefer.
Looking at me in a very steely way, then, wouldn't you? I won't say very much about the Juba peace talks. Other people might want to say a bit more about that. But I suppose one issue about the Juba peace talks that's worth bearing in mind is that the Juba peace negotiations were the first peace negotiations of that kind under the International Criminal Court umbrella. It's something that we often don't really think about very much, but the Rome Statute of the Criminal Court, it ends impunity for the worst of crimes. And so, you know, there is this issue about how do you negotiate in a situation where there is no impunity? And so there's lots you can say about the Juba peace talks, and it may well be that the ICC had a very little, very small role in why they failed, but it is interesting to note that they did fail, and it does raise this issue about, well, what does ending impunity actually look like? It actually means you can't have a kind of South African option or a Mozambique option. It closes that off, and that's something important to think about. In terms of rehabilitating those child soldiers, well, of course, many of those people I was referring to earlier, the 30,000 young people who were taken, they were child soldiers, most of them. And so what was offered to them? Psychosocial support for a few weeks and then being dumped in camps where many of them were taken away again. I mean, one of the most disturbing aspects that I think has occurred to all of us probably who've worked in this area is the way that sometimes those young people, when you get to know them well, start talking about their experiences in the Lord's Resistance Army in a very positive way, about the pleasure they took in killing people in a way that was approved, the thrill of living in a space where moral norms are not applied, the incredible freedom of being able to live in Olum, the bush, in a way that and they could be safe, but to do these horrendous things. And so some of them talk about it as the best things that ever happened to them in their lives. And so, you know, whatever, I'm not saying all of them, but there are quite a few. But overall, following up, and Costanza's been involved in a bit of this work in northern Uganda, doing field work with us. There was the point about Acholi's not forgiving. I mean, an Acholi Timokecha, which was something that was talked about all the time during those original years when the criminal court first became involved. People said, no, no, the Acholi people, they know how to forgive. They have all these local rituals, Matoaput, Guomotong, which should be an alternative to international criminal justice. So it's kind of interesting that we're all sitting here and saying, well, actually, the Acholis don't forgive. That was always my experience. You know, I remember sitting with this woman crying, surrounded by the graves of her children, and I was asking her, you know, what do you think about the people who did this to your children? Do you forgive them? And she said, yes, I forgive them. But then after crying for some time, she said, I can't look at them with dark eyes now, but I know who they are. And that was in 2004. You know, and what you see now, you know, 10 years after all, you know, after the camps were broken up, the follow-up of people who came through that process is absolutely horrific. I mean, the stories that we've collected of those young people who came back through the reception centres and then were left 10 years after they were settled, there's hardly a positive story. You know, women have been passed around from one man to another. Their children have been killed, raped. Men can't get land. They're pushed to the edges of villages. People don't forgive, and they remember. And so even though maybe these young people were taken and forced to do these things, there is an idea in the Choli of Chen, of the sort of spiritual pollution of people who have perpetrated or been in an extremely violent place that is harms people around them. And so people are frightened to have these people in their homes. So even, you know, women have been forced to abandon their children and go into hiding. I mean, absolutely horrific stories. And it's just got worse and worse in the years since they've come back. And as I said, the first time they've ever been followed up is when we went to look for them.
I'm not sure about this Acholis don't forgive. I'm not an authority on the Acholi people. I'm bearing authority on myself. But I suspect they are like most everybody else, I suppose. You know, they forgive some and they cannot forgive the unforgivable. But it always struck me as interesting when a lot of people were asked about Ongwen would say, yes, he's done bad things. And by those people, I mean people that were like supposed to be his wives, in quotes, people that he had married, in quotes, when he was in the bush. And they would say things like, yes, they did bad things, but we understand why. It's the idea of the experience, the common experience. People understand what happened and went through it. And, you know, and this brings me to the Coelho case. And I'm sorry I couldn't. I mean, Fred, I think it would come as a huge surprise to Coelho, who was sitting in a prison in Luzira, that he has been acquitted. Because he is not. He's been in prison for 7, 8 years now. And in fact, he was abducted as a child. And I was in Gulu throughout the court cases. And most people said that they understood and he shouldn't have been in prison. And he shouldn't have been even charged because he was eligible for amnesty. He was not part of the ICC indictments. And yet he was taken into custody and still there for very unclear legal reasons. And if they're going to prosecute Coelho, they might as well prosecute thousands of other Larry fighters. So this point of, again, I'm not to be polemical here, but I'm just saying that I slightly disagree with that, and the Coelho case I think was also an important. And it's also part of the reason why George does not want to be public anymore, because he is worried that when we started this project, he was happy to be the face of this book, to come out and talk, and hopefully maybe even be here. But the way that the system has been used for political reasons has terrified people who have been in the LRA, and some of them who cannot come back because they are afraid that they might.